my reason for reading those two verses in chapter 5. We happen at the moment to be looking at the first epistle to Timothy in our Bible readings at York Street in Leicester. And yesterday evening we were looking at this section which deals with widows and widows that are widows indeed. And I intend, God willing, to focus attention on the passage in 1 Timothy chapter 2. But we were looking at verse 10, and these features, of course, this is verse 10 of chapter 5, these features that should mark a widow to be taken onto the roll, taken into the number, to be provided for, these features really are lovely features that should mark the sisters in the assembly, well reported of for good works. We were thinking of Phoebe in Romans chapter 16. If she have brought up children, well, it's Timothy, and so we think of Eunice and Lois. And if she have lodged strangers, well, we thought of Lydia. If she have washed the saints' feet, well, it was Mary who washed the Lord's feet. If she have relieved the afflicted, we were thinking about Dorcas or Tabitha, as she was known. If she have diligently followed every good work, don't forget Persis in Romans chapter 16. But those are lovely features that should mark Christian women. Now, I'm sure we appreciate that the key verse in this first epistle to Timothy is indeed chapter 3 and verse 15. But if I tarry long, that thou mayest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth. Well, I want to emphasize that there's nothing to justify the idea that instruction was merely being given to Timothy as to his conduct. And the literal rendering probably is more like this, how it is necessary. That's a general statement, how it is necessary to behave in the house of God. The issue at stake then is the maintenance of a testimony for God and a maintenance of that testimony locally. And we need to bear in mind that that testimony should reflect upon God himself. And the basic purpose of this letter, therefore, is to unfold to Timothy, and that in a systematic way, and through him to the believers there at Ephesus, and hence to ourselves, the conduct expected of those who form part of a scripturally gathered company, seen here, of course, under the figure of the house of God. In the verse that precedes in chapter 3, we read, "These things write I unto you, hoping to come unto thee shortly." And when Paul uses these words, these things would naturally refer primarily to the contents of chapters 1, 2, and 3. We realize, of course, that chapter 1 is largely introductory, and it deals with the matter of doctrine. But this is followed in chapter 2 by prayer, and then, of course, those verses that we've read together, by the woman's position in the assembly. And then, of course, when we come into chapter 3, we have this church government. We have elders spoken of and also deacons. Now, the verses that we read then, I read from verse 8 and there was a purpose in that, but the verses 9 through to 15 of chapter 2 deal with the women's position in the assembly. And I do want to emphasize that verses 9 and 10 are closely associated with the preceding section dealing with public prayers. And I believe that they give to us the place of women in such a gathering. I want you to observe the expression in verse 9, "in like manner." And that really is to be construed in an adverbial way with the I will of verse 8. So that these instructions are essentially part of the same directive. I do wish to stress that a vital part of the atmosphere in the public gatherings of the saints will be established by the dress, and not only the dress, but also the demeanour of the women present. Now, I must emphasise that women in the church pray. And I just want to ask the sisters present in the meeting this evening whether you have been praying in the prayer meeting. Because women in the church pray, but they pray silently from the heart. And they are, of course, dressed in modest apparel, displaying the marks of godly women. So, I do trust that the sisters will not be critical of the brethren and say, well, the brethren were a little bit slow in rising to their feet in the prayer meeting, because you should be praying in the assembly prayer meeting. Suffer the word of exhortation. Now, there are four key words relating to the woman in this section, verses 9 to 15. And these words are, number one, sobriety. We find that in verse 9 and in verse 15. Then secondly, we have the word silence. That is in verse 11 and again in verse 12. Then thirdly, we have the word subjection. We find that in verse 11. And then fourthly, we have the idea of salvation. And I point you to the word saved in verse 15. So there are these four key words: sobriety, silence, subjection, and salvation. Let's look then at verses 9 and 10, which essentially are concerned with sobriety. The instructions that are given here in this chapter concerning the position of women in the church emphasize certain aspects of what Paul had taught, I suppose, some 6 years previously to the Corinthians. Now, you will perhaps appreciate that according to 1 Corinthians chapter 11, the problem at Corinth had been the refusal on the part of some women to wear the head covering. But here, in 1 Timothy chapter 2, some 6 years later, it is the other extreme. The problem is the other extreme of over-decoration. Now, generally speaking, dress expresses taste and it displays character. Thus, how a woman dresses really shows what kind of woman she is. Now, inevitably, the subject has wider implications than the gatherings of the saints. For the habitual and daily apparel of the woman reflects what she is. So Paul advocates that Christian women adorn themselves, and he qualifies this by adding four prohibitions and then four recommendations. For their adornment, these women are not to depend, number one, upon broided hair. Number two, gold. Number three, pearls. Number four, costly array. But on the other hand, he does encourage, number one, modest apparel. Number two, shamefacedness. Number three, sobriety. Together with good works. So we have this general expression that women adorn themselves in modest apparel. Now, if we were to go back to the Mosaic law, we would find that that law enjoined a distinction between the attire of men and the attire of women. Now, that verse in Deuteronomy and chapter 25 is often resorted to. The woman shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all that do so are an abomination unto the Lord. And it's quite right to stress the strong language used at the end of the verse, that word abomination unto the Lord thy God. Now, I should point out that, strictly speaking, I sincerely believe that that verse in Deuteronomy chapter 25 is warning against cross-dressing. It's warning against transvestism. That's the context of that verse. Now, although no specific directions and directives are given in the New Testament epistles as to how men should dress, both Paul here and Peter in his first epistle, they give instructions as to the dress of women. Now, in verse 9, the verb adorn and the adjective modest are really related words derived from the same root meaning. In other words, it's the idea of to arrange or to order. So, literally, women are to arrange themselves in well-arranged dress. We might be inclined to say, in good taste. However, it should be emphasized that this arrangement or this orderliness is not to be that of the fashion model of the world. It extends beyond the blending of color schemes or matching fabrics to the relationship of her apparel or her apparel to her Christian character and testimony. That is the important point. Now, the women are certainly not encouraged to adopt some form of eccentric dress likely to attract attention because of its drabness. Paul didn't expect sisters to be attired in dowdy or in a slovenly manner. But neither did he desire that there should be a showy display of expensive fashion. So it's not only a question of dress, but it's also a matter of demeanour. Because we have these words added with shamefacedness and sobriety. Now, this word translated shamefacedness, it only occurs here in the New Testament. And it has been defined as that inner grace that recoils from anything unseemly, anything improper. It is indeed a rejection of even the appearance of overstepping the limits of feminine reserve. Modesty really gives the meaning quite well. Shamefacedness. We could substitute that word for modesty. But then, it's not only shamefacedness, but it is sobriety. And the word sobriety describes that balanced state of mind and linking it with good judgment, which underlies the whole decorum of women of God. Now, I want you now to notice the four accessories that are not in keeping with the well-arranged apparel of godly women. I repeat them again. Number one, broided hair. Number two, gold. Number three, pearls. Number four, costly array. Now, it is expected that a woman, if possible, would have long hair. We, of course, resort to the passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. If a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her. Whilst, of course, a man is disparaged by having long hair. That same passage tells us, if a man have long hair, it is a shame unto him. So a woman is distinguished by having long hair. Sadly, of course, in the world there is a marked tendency to blur that distinctiveness of the sexes as created by God. But a woman, if possible, should have long hair. Now, it's probable that the first two terms, broided hair and gold, should not be joined by that conjunction or, but rather by the conjunction and, broided hair and gold. Because the apostle is probably referring to the custom that was common among the wealthy women of Ephesian society of having elaborate hairdos intertwined with gold or with jewels. But then we have these added prohibitions, or pearls, or costly array. Now, in ancient Oriental culture, women of wealth often decorated themselves, and they decorated themselves profusely with pearls and other forms of expensive jewellery. And such elaborate coiffure, extravagant display, and expensive dress are inappropriate for godly women. That is quite clear from these verses here in 1 Timothy chapter 2. And furthermore, in a society like ours, where many wear clothing which is perhaps very expensive as to cost, but economical as to coverage, we do well to note again that requirement for modest apparel. But those are the negative things, and we want to look at the positive side. In a positive sense, women should adorn themselves with good works rather than with tinsel and finery. Good works which becometh women professing godliness. In godly women, what they profess by lip will be fittingly reflected in their deeds and in their actions. They should adorn themselves with good works. Indeed, while good works are often commended in these pastoral epistles, the two to Timothy and the one to Titus, this exact expression I found, good works in the plural, it occurs only elsewhere in the New Testament in Acts chapter 9. And I've already mentioned the lady concerned. There it describes Dorcas. This woman was full of good works and alms deeds which she did. And Dorcas, of course, is a fine example of one of Scripture's spiritual ladies, well worthy of emulation by any woman who professes godliness. So the dignity of spiritual femininity is seen not in the external display of the women of the world, but in the expression of true godliness. Now, we've read these verses from 1 Timothy chapter 2, but Peter puts it like this: whose adorning? Let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting the hair, and of wearing of gold, or of putting on of apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart, in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. So there in verses 9 and 10, the emphasis is upon sobriety. Now we come to the next section, verses 11 through to 14. These deal with silence and subjection. Now these verses quite clearly deal with a woman's behaviour in the house of God. Number one, she is to be a learner. Number two, she is to be silent. Number three, she's not to be a teacher. Number four, she's not to usurp, she's not to exercise authority over the man. She's to be a learner, she's to be silent, she's not to be a teacher, she's not to usurp authority over the man. First of all then, she is to be a learner. Let the women learn. Now it's wrong to think that a woman is not to learn in the assembly. Since in such in the assembly gatherings, you'll appreciate that all of us should be instructed. I do seek to bear in mind that in a company such as this, there are those who've been on the Christian pathway for many years. And many of the things, of course, that we say will be well known to folk who have been on the pathway for a considerable period of time. But there's the principle of restating truth. This second epistle says, Peter, beloved, I write unto you, in both which I stir up your pure minds by way of remembrance. But we also need to bear in mind that there are those who have not long been saved. And in a meeting like this, there should be something for older brethren, for older sisters, for younger sisters, and for younger brethren. So all should be instructed in such a gathering as this. Now, the word translated learn indicates the attentive learning and observation of the woman to take in that which is for her spiritual growth and blessing. And Paul evidently appreciated the value of well-instructed sisters whose example and counsel would have a profound effect on the character of any assembly. I will just say this, we're thankful that there are sisters who are well-instructed in the assembly at York Street in Leicester, and if I'm ministering the word there and I get a few nods of assent from such sisters, well, I know that I'm on the right line. So it's lovely to have well-taught spiritual sisters in the assembly because they can affect the character of the whole. But you see, the way in which a sister learns is in some respects different from that by which a brother learns. Since, of course, in certain meetings, a brother may ask a question, but that, of course, is not permitted to a sister. We come over to 1 Corinthians chapter 14, and we read, and if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home. But I just want to pose this question. Has the spiritual edification, the spiritual building up of sisters being neglected? Now the remedy for this is not to convene special sisters meetings, far from it, but rather for the teaching brethren in the local assembly to ensure that the teaching in ministry and Bible readings is such as sisters can assimilate and from which they can profit. So we read that verse, let the woman learn. So she is to be a learner. Secondly, she is to be silent. Let the woman learn in silence. If we go over to the passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, Paul says, let your women keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak. And then again, in that same chapter, it is a shame for women to speak in the church. Now, such silence evidences neither resentment nor bondage. But I do trust that it stems from a willing acceptance of the sphere that Scripture gives to women. You know, there is the force of that expression, with or in all subjection. I want to emphasize, it's not here subjection to man, but rather subjection to the teaching of Scripture. Again, will you note the words all subjection? That is to say, a subjection manifest in every possible way. Not looking for some escape. Not looking for some loophole from the truth that is being enjoined and commanded. So, the woman is to be silent. But then thirdly, she's not to be a teacher. There appears to be a progression in these verses. Number one, learn in silence. That's verse 11. Number two, not to teach. Verse 12. Again, verse 12. Number three, nor to usurp authority over the man. Coming back then to verse 12. But I suffer not, I permit not a woman to teach. It's not some single act that is in view, but a process. You see, to assume the position of a public teacher in the assembly is not given to a woman. Now, this prohibition on teaching is given in the context of the public gatherings of the assembly. And that women are well able to teach in other settings of a private nature is quite clear from the example of Priscilla. You remember that Aquila and Priscilla took him, that is Apollos, unto them and expounded unto him the way of God more perfectly. So, Aquila and Priscilla, in fact it's the other order, Priscilla and Aquila, they took Apollos into their home and instructed him in the way of God more perfectly. Then of course there is the teaching of older sisters to the younger. We come to the epistle to Titus and chapter 2. The aged women teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, to love their children. In fact, I judge that this is an important ministry, which is to a large extent sadly neglected in the present day. So the women, they do teach, but in their own particular sphere. Number four then, she is not to usurp authority, she's not to exercise authority over the man. The verb really means to exercise authority on one's own account. In fact, it's quite a strong expression. It really means to domineer over. And for a woman to assume a position of domination over the man is totally inconsistent with her divinely assigned position of subjection to the man. But to be in silence. And that repetition of the demand to be in silence or to be in quietness brings out, by way of contrast, of course, the proper position of the women. And the apostle, he now proceeds in verses 13 and 14, and this is seen in the opening word for of verse 13, he now proceeds to undergird his preceding exhortations, and he's giving to us scriptural reasons. The first of which is Adam's priority in formation. Adam was first formed, then Eve. So here, particular significance is being given to the sequence of events, the temporal sequence of events. You see, God in creation, he gave Adam a place of leadership, he gave him a place of headship. And Eve, by the very act of the Creator, was appointed to a place of submission. Though she was second, she was not secondary. In person, she was to be Adam's equal. But in position, she was to be Adam's helper and help meet for him, suitable for him, and subject to him. Now, it is notable that throughout these verses, Paul uses the terms woman and women, or man and men. So here he is regarding each from the standpoint of creation, rather than from the standpoint of redemption. Now the apostle, at this particular point, he is drawing his teaching from Genesis chapter 2. So headship of man and submission of the woman predate the fall. It's Genesis chapter 2. So the distinctive roles given by God to male and female were in place before the entry of sin. So there we have Adam's priority in formation. But then secondly, we're directed to Eve's priority in the fall. The woman, being deceived, was in the transgression. So we're now moving from the divine order of Genesis chapter 2 into what we might term the satanic disorder of Genesis chapter 3. In Genesis chapter 2, Adam was first. However, when we come to Genesis chapter 3, it is the woman who assumes the position of leadership. And very craftily, the serpent reversed God's order of male leadership and made his first approach to Eve, thus giving the woman the place of precedence. She took the initiative in response to the lie of the serpent. And the fall that is designated here, the transgression, the fall was caused by the collusion of the man and the woman, with the woman leading the way and the man following. If you go back to Genesis chapter 3, you will find such expressions as she saw, she took, she ate, she gave, and only then does it say he ate. And so our verse in 1 Timothy chapter 2 goes on to say, Adam was not deceived. So Adam, he partook of the forbidden fruit, and he did so with his eyes wide open. He did it deliberately, being fully aware of the consequences. And we have to acknowledge that wherever God's order is disregarded, disaster will follow. And that is most evident in Genesis chapter 3. So the woman's place in creation determines her position in the local assembly, whilst her part in the fall fixes her function in the assembly. Now we come to this fourth word, salvation, verse 15. Notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing. Now the apostle, he concludes this section with positive encouragement to women. And following those negative prohibitions of the preceding verses, this strong word notwithstanding is introducing a positive promise. The reference here, of course, is not to the salvation of her soul, but rather to the salvation of her life and the salvation of her service. You see, the woman's proper sphere is that of the home, and that of motherhood. And through childbearing, rather than in childbearing. The word implies the many duties of motherhood and womanhood, recognized within the home sphere. And through childbearing, the woman would be saved from intruding into a sphere that God had not given to her. That's the idea. And this function of childbearing is actually singled out for special mention because, of course, it is the primary experience which distinguishes woman from man. Her salvation is by a continuance in the four virtues that are now indicated in our verse. Faith, and charity, and holiness with sobriety. You see, these are the four hallmarks of true Christianity and are available to all women, whether married or single, whether mothers or childless. Faith and love are the root virtues which produce the good fruits of holiness, or if you like, sanctification and sobriety. I'd want you to notice that there is a change in this verse from the singular to the plural. It commences with she, and it concludes with if they continue. But you may have noticed that a similar change is seen earlier in this very passage, in verses 9 and 10. In verses 9 and 10, we read of women, plural. Then in the verses which immediately follow, the apostle switches to the singular. So here it is in the inverse order. So the teaching, therefore, applies not only to all Christian women, wherever they might be found, they. But it applies to them as individuals, she. So the apostle here, he clearly emphasizes the blessedness of womanhood in the full execution of her God-given privileges and responsibilities. These are most important verses, and they are dealt with in this epistle, which has to do with the local assembly. Sobriety, silence, subjection, and salvation. We trust the Lord will bless his word.